books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got a mixture of fiction and non-fiction. Becky C. Brynhoff will tell us about her debut novel, I Found a Body, and Daniel Tammet will explore Nine Minds in Our Lives on the Spectrum. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Out now is I Found a Body by Becky C. Brynhoff. Detective Sergeant Mona Hendricks has enough on her plate. She is separated from her husband, her teenage daughter is punishing her for it, and she's having to babysit. When her daughter's favourite influencer, Kylie Mae, finds a dead body and broadcasts it to the world, Mona is thrown into a very public murder investigation. We'll hear from Becky in a moment, but first, the audio version of I Found a Body is read by Katie Sobey.
And like I said before, guys, I'll take you on a tour of our gorgeous little dream cabin right after this. A and I had a late night, so I wanted to let my love bug have a lie-in. He's resting in the cosiest, most sustainably sourced bedsheets. So hang tight. Good things come to those who wait. Kylie's freehand, off camera, gives the middle finger in Clive's general direction. Crows flap and screech louder than before as Kylie nears a stream. She gasps, almost offended, when she's showered with raindrops from the balding branches above. She tries to rush out from under the falling water when her foot lands with a heavy splash right in the middle of a shallow trench. It stretches across her path, as if a tree trunk has been dragged from one bank of trees to the other.
"Oh my God, you guys," she says. "Clumsy Clementine here has absolutely wrecked these boots. Look!"
She points the camera at the ground. The trench sucks and squelches around Kylie's foot as she pulls a soggy boot out of the muddy water. It's the most exciting thing to have happened on the live stream so far. She may as well show it to everyone. She holds the screen back up to her face and blinks at a frantic stream of comments.
"What? Bird funeral, squawk, squawk.
Is this like a staged horror thing? Love it. Don't kill birds for likes.
Disgusting.
Eat it. Do you sell foot pics?
I don't claim any negative energy from this.
I Found a Body is sort of modern crime novel. It kicks off with an influencer who's doing a live stream in a forest, and she stumbles across a dead body. And rather than call the police, she keeps filming. And the rest of the story follows kind of a dual point of view between the influencer Kylie Mae and the detective on the case, Mona Hendricks. But it's also dual timeline as well. So not to give too much away, but the case doesn't get solved in the present day. And what we do is we jump forward 9 years every now and then and see how this case not being solved just yet has a massive impact on both of these women's lives. It's a proper whodunit right up to the very last page. And people seem to be really enjoying it, which is brilliant news for me because I spent a long time working on it.
Kylie asks what they're all talking about and scans the ground. A disembodied wing lies drenched in her path. Horrified, she wonders aloud where the rest of it is. She shunts it away with a sweep of her foot before giving over to a full body shudder. The viewing figure rises by another 100 viewers. She recovers, giving the camera as unbothered a smile as she can manage and takes a few steps forward. Until she sees something up ahead. Something lying in the stream. Something pale, round and alien against the rich and jagged autumn palette. Kylie's mouth hangs open, her brain trying to register what her body knows instinctively. Stay back. Danger.
Now, I believe Kylie wasn't really a character in the early drafts of the novel. It was just Mona's story.
Yeah, it was initially just going to be all about Mona, like this sort of hard-bitten classic, female detective. But I had really good early feedback from my writing group who were like, it was just going to be Kylie was going to find the body and then we'd never see her again. I thought it was an interesting way to bring us into the story. But they were like, no, she's really interesting and she gives you this sort of interesting thing to talk about, which is it's true. I'm really sort of preoccupied with, I guess, the internet and how social media impacts our lives and this idea of true crime and real crime bumping up against each other and how all these armchair detectives and so on. And I thought there is just something to be said for this strange modern age that we're living in at the moment.
Now, you mentioned that writing group there. Was that what really inspired you to push through and write the novel?
Yeah, so I did the Faber Academy Writing a Novel course, which has produced a lot of finished novels, which is really good value for money there. And yeah, working like the group, it's lovely. We're all in the same WhatsApp group together called Writers' Tears After the Whiskey. And we really do egg each other on and we celebrate and commiserate with each other. Our sample of I Found a Body was in the Faber anthology that goes out after the writing a novel course. I suppose a mixture of my writing group spurred me to keep on going with finishing it, but also some interest from agents, which was fantastic. Made me think, right, I better finish this if I actually want to see it out in the world, because annoyingly, books don't get written unless you actually sit down and write them.
Cass, you know I can't promise that, Mona says. There's a moment of silence. In the rearview mirror, Cass's face is in tortured contemplation. Fine, I won't take your phone, Mona concedes, if only to expedite things. Is this real? Cass asks, leaning forward until the seatbelt strains against her neck. She wiggles her phone in her mum's face. Not while I'm driving! Mona jerks her head to the side, but Cassie doesn't take the hint. She pushes the phone further into Mona's eyeline, no matter how deeply the seatbelt digs into her skin. I'm driving, kid! You have to look, though! Quick! Cass whines.
Now, Kylie, she tries to solve the murder, but she's hindering the investigation. Were there any real life cases that inspired that?
Yeah, so prior to the book being written, I think the most sort of notorious kind of case of influencer and true crime and dead body and so on and so forth, probably Logan Paul, who some people might only know him from wrestling now, but people my age will remember him from back in those days of YouTube when he very controversially went to a forest in Japan and found someone who had died by suicide and uploaded a video of it. He courted a lot of controversy off the back of that, but it didn't really do his career any harm. Like he's a very famous professional wrestler now. But yeah, I think there's just a quite an obsession with true crime, and I think we've been people, society have been sort of literally and figuratively pointing our cameras at dead bodies for some time now, whether it's, people getting obsessed with what happened to Nicola Bulley and actually like intruding on the crime scene, or we swap recommendations for true crime documentaries and murder podcasts and things like that. Even like recently with the really tragic case about Gene Hackman before the truth was revealed, like all this speculation and theories like racing around the internet. And I think it's something that we're really obsessed with. And Kylie was a great way to show that on the page.
Are you a fan of true crime yourself? Because the message boards in the book are surprisingly accurate.
Yeah, I'm definitely a lurker of like Reddit boards and this one particular forum called Tattle Life that's very celebrity focused. And I think Tattle Life is definitely a heavy inspiration for the tone of those forums in the book. So much so that a couple of influencers that I've worked with before and have read the book have said, like, that really reminded me of reading about myself on Tattle Life. I was like, yeah, that's what I was going for. But yeah, I think people. And because I work in social media as well, I'm very used to just how people can feel very uninhibited and very bold when they're hiding behind a fake name. And I really wanted that to come across in the book. I think if a lot of these people were using their real names or people knew what their jobs were, kind of thing, they probably would have been a lot more conservative about their views and what they were saying. But it's just people can kind of get away with all sorts now on the internet, so long as you're hiding behind a fake username.
Was it hard to get into Mona's character because she says she doesn't and has never got social media at all?
You know what? It wasn't, because I've been working in social media for such a long time that I have a kind of love-hate relationship with it, I would say. So there's definitely a part of me that's very chronically online, very switched on, can explain memes that are like six layers deep. But also, I do really love, and I'm going to do this at the end of this week, actually. I'll just log out of everything and just have like a good couple of weeks of detox where I'm just not, every time I pick up my phone, I'm not immediately opening up another social media app. So that side of me, I think, definitely connects with Mona, where it's just like, it's just not for her. She doesn't want any part of it. And she's able to focus without that. Whereas I'm like, yeah, I'm able to focus a lot more when I'm not actually like, I can't just pick up my phone and just have it there and suddenly be like, why did I pick this up again? I can't remember.
Now, was it a hard book to write, considering it's two points of view and two different timelines? I'm picturing, you know, the cork board with the pieces of string going across it and things.
Oh, there was a big whiteboard at one point in one of the spare room. I had like lots of little pieces of paper and I was just trying to make sure that I had everything in the right place, and then just transferring everything into Scrivener, which is a really handy program to sort of keep track of all your chapters. I think the hardest thing was, because the initial word count was about 125,000 words, and my lovely editor, Rachel Morell at Black and White, she was like, this is great. I need you to cut it down by at least 30,000 words. And so going through that process and making sure that all the breadcrumbs were still in place, because I was trying to lay the foundations down in present day, in the future, in both points of view, in both timelines, so that the reader felt satisfied at the end when all the reveals were revealed, that they could look back and be like, oh no, yeah, that was there all along. That was staring me in the face. That was hinted at. And making sure all those hints were still there when I went through the word cull, that was really tricky. That was a very hard part of the editing process. But we got there, and I think it's a much better book for being shorter, for sure.
Ice shoots through Kylie's veins. A body. A woman's body. Lying half in, half out of the stream. Browning ferns hang heavy with rainwater over the body's face. Dark purple and blue spots blot its flesh. Water jostles over the body undeterred, bursting the stream's banks and washing the pale legs clean. The body wears greying knickers that hug its hips too tightly. They'll leave a mark, Kylie thinks, before feeling a deep shame in her stomach for having the thought at all. It really doesn't matter if there's a mark or not. It won't matter to this person ever again. A vivid memory comes to Kylie of lying in the dark last night, listening to what she was sure at the time was birds screeching during the storm. Not birds. Screaming.
That's Katie Sobey with another clip from I Found a Body by Becky C. Brynholt, my guest today. Now, did you have any choice in the narrator of the audio version of the book?
They did send over a clip of Katie just doing a sample of the book, and I loved it so much straight away, because especially with the forums, there are so many different voices, and I've tried to, as much as possible, make them individual characters that you could imagine not have their own backstories and everything. And Katie totally picked up on that, which is great, and she's kind of given them all different accents and different tones and different moods, and I just thought, yeah, she gets it, and I was really delighted. She's narrating my book, and she lives in Bristol, which is where the book is set, so I was like, okay, she'll get that accent nailed for the ones that are really overtly West Country.
Did you ever consider reading the audio version yourself?
I did a drama degree. It was drama teaching, but you do a little bit of drama in it. But I am nowhere near talented enough an actor to be able to do that. I think it's a real skill to be able to narrate an audiobook really, really well. I think I would have just got embarrassed. I think I would have been constantly self-editing in my head as well while I was reading it. I would have been like, oh no, I shouldn't have written that. Oh, that's terrible. Oh no. So I think having that degree of separation is really good. And I can just enjoy it as a listener and a reader rather than critiquing my own performance, I suppose.
Now, this is a Silly question because I know where you work, but now it's available in audio. Is it important that it's now accessible for everyone who doesn't have a relationship with print?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'd love for my book to be read by as many people as possible in whatever format is most accessible to them. I mean, for me at the moment, I am listening to a lot of audiobooks right now because I've got a baby. So sometimes just having an audiobook on around the house while I'm wandering around trying to do chores, trying to rock the baby to sleep is so much more helpful than, you know, having to pick up a big hard pack, which is kind of impossible at the moment. I have one free hand at any one time. But yeah, so even for me in this situation I'm at the moment where that's a really accessible format for me, and then obviously where I work, RNIB, I know all too well that audio formats or like say braille formats, would be lovely to see my book in braille as well, are more accessible formats for the people that RNIB serves.
We should mention it. What actually is your job at RNIB?
I am the head of digital engagement.
So it's surprising you wrote a book about an influencer.
Yeah. Yes, I was head of social media up until I started maternity leave, and I'm coming back to a brand new role, which is really exciting. But yeah, I think all my years of working in social media just made me think like, yeah, I think I've got this voice nailed. I think I can do this.
Now, you've actually preempted this question by publishing this online, which is amazing. But could you give us a little audio description of the cover of I Found a Body?
Absolutely. So I think I should start out by saying it is bright, hot pink and glittery. And the title, I Found a Body, is in this lime green block capital drop shadow font. So it really stands out. And the tagline is an influencer, a dead body and a live stream. There's a small pool of blood on the front cover, and then these disembodied Barbie doll limbs, so an arm and a leg, kind of lying in the pool of blood. And then there's a quote from Anoni Forbat that says, a page turner that has you hooked from the start, which I'm not going to fight her on that.
Kylie exhales from the bottom of her lungs and stands up straight, her head swimming. The viewing number rolls past 9,000. Holding the phone with a shaking hand, Kylie uses the camera as a mirror and wipes away tears, snot, sick, and half her makeup with the back of her hand, in front of thousands. Hi, everyone, she mumbles, waving a ruined glove. I'm... Hysterical messages and alerts keep racing up the screen. Adam calls her. Kylie declines. She sniffs, clears her throat and mouths a couple of four-letter words at the sky. Then a notion intrudes. The briefest suggestion, not fully formed. She doesn't interrogate it at all. Kylie takes a few steps closer to the body. Her heart pounds in her throat and ears. Somewhere in the distance, she hears Adam shouting her name. Shrugging the dread off her skin, she turns her back to the dead body and frames it in the shot just over her left shoulder, her good side. The comments and notifications are a blur. The viewing figure rolls past 25,000. Hi, guys.
I Found a Body by Becky C. Brownhoff is available in print as an ebook and an audio as read by Katie Sobey. And Becky, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Becky will be back later in the show with the books of her life. Plus, coming up later, Daniel Tammet will explore nine minds in our lives on the spectrum. But first,
brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. For fans of psychological thrillers, I Know It's You by Susan Lewis has recently arrived from HarperCollins.
I think it might work for you, Noel Hadigan is saying, seeming both certain and curious as he assesses the landing of his proposition. His eyes are mischievous, and then less so, as he gives a quick wave to someone he knows. Bad choice of restaurant. He can never come to the Ivy in Covent Garden without being recognised, and he'd much rather be focusing on the woman seated opposite him. Marina Forster treats him to one of her famously wry smiles as he turns back to her. She's always happy to spend time with this man, especially when he's up to something, and he clearly is, so it's easy to allow her turquoise blue eyes to show interest, in spite of having heard him start a pitch this way many times before.
The first chapter of a manuscript arrives on publisher Marina's desk. She assumes it's just another novel by another aspiring writer. As the chapters arrive one by one, Marina is convinced they're about her past. There's only one person who can know everything about the scandal, the trial, and the trauma that nearly broke her. This is one story that should never be told, and Marina is so desperate she will do anything to stop it getting out.
She's a tall, strikingly lovely woman in her mid-40s, with thick, dark hair, usually wound into a single French plait. Delicately pale skin, lusciously defined features, and an air of confidence that's easily matched by her natural warmth. Her reputation for being a great boss and insightful publisher is, according to most, entirely deserved. For, over the past 11 years, since returning from the hiatus of becoming a mother, she's steadily built up the dedicated fiction division of Hawksley Maine, an international publishing house. It is now an award-winning, widely respected, and highly profitable arm of the business. She'd even name the imprint Janus, after the god of beginnings, transitions, and endings. "Can't wait to hear what it is," she teases, and pops a forkful of deliciously baked salmon into her mouth before raising a glass of sparkling water. He knows, as do most literary agents in town, that she, as an executive publishing director, rarely takes on a new work. She has a superbly talented and mostly independent team for that. However, there are exceptions. Usually they come in the shape of celebrities or politicians whose egos and agents insist on being handled by the person at the top, even if the actual editing is carried out by a senior member of the team. "It's coming from an unknown," he tells her, "unless the name is a pseudonym. And I guess that's likely. All I have right now are initials and a surname." "Don't tell me. J.K. Rowling," he laughs. "Hardly unknown. But certainly, Rowling set a trend, and it isn't such a bad one, if you don't want your identity to influence early judgment." "So, are you thinking someone famous could be behind it?" He shrugs. "Too soon to say. But the author is definitely going for gender neutral right now. And the first chapter is..." He searches for the right word and is clearly disappointed in himself when all he can muster is interesting.
I Know It's You by Susan Lewis is read by Laura Kirkman, Helen Stern and Claire Will and runs for 10 hours, 41 minutes.
There are many readers who love an historical mystery. New in the library, The Birdcage Library by Freya Berry was donated by Headline.
Every life has its own lie. I think of them as like plants. Lies, I mean. Doubtless this is due to my botanist's profession. Some are tame and neat. Cottage garden geraniums, sprucing up the exterior. Others are subtler, wilier. Their roots sunk deep. There is a third kind, the creepers, the vines, plants of the jungle, parasites. Lovingly they reach up and in, entwining themselves with their host, slowly but surely leeching its life away. The train snaked up Scotland's west flank, coiling through the peaks of Argyll, winding its way around Loch Linnhe. The landscape grew bleaker, green bowing to red bracken, not dissimilar in colour to my hair. My skin gleamed pale in the window, paler since our arrival. My father and I had spent 7 years absorbing the Australian sun, only for it to disperse in a matter of weeks. I felt guilty for leaving him, though I could hardly have refused the fortuitous employment offer I'd received.
It's 1932. An adventuress and plant hunter, Emily Blackwood, accepts a commission from Heinrich Vogel, a former dealer of exotic animals in Manhattan, living now with his macabre collection in a remote Scottish castle. Emily is tasked to find a long-lost treasure which Heinrich believes has been hidden within the castle walls. But instead she discovers the pages of a diary written by Hester Vogel, who died after falling from the Brooklyn Bridge. Hester's diary leads Emily to an old book, the Birdcage Library, and into a treasure hunt of another kind, one that will take her down a dangerous path for clues and force her to confront her own darkest secret.
The train was a rickety-looking thing, with an air of frontier bravado. I changed onto it at Glasgow and made sure to request my stop with the gaunt conductor, as my new employer had directed in his letter. The handwriting was elegant, flared. "They're all request stops here, miss." "Blackwood. Emily Blackwood." He nodded bleakly, returning my ticket as a bishop dispenses a wafer to a sinner. His lugubriousness was at odds with the countryside's vaulting magnificence, but it seeped in as we left tourist country with its viaducts and waterfalls, pretty train stations and tamed lochs, the winding roads that led nowhere, and the white crofters' cottages pebbling the bracken like rocks' eggs in a giant nest. The sky outside grew greyer, draped over humpbacked hills that somehow both crouched and loomed. The stations grew smaller, or perhaps the hills reared higher. This far north, nature had different rules. I saw it in the passengers, iron under their skin. It was easy to believe that wolves had lived here once, sleek shadows winding through the pines. It was a long way from the cloud forests of Papua. I'd been on expedition there, collecting new and rare plants not 5 months since. It was on a brief visit to Port Moresby to pick up an insulin shipment that I received a frantic message from my childhood friend Daniel Lowe. It said that the small but adequate funds he had been managing for my father and me had been lost. All of it, in the roilings of the Depression. I'd returned immediately to Sydney to organise our affairs, then booked us a cargo ship back to England. All we could now afford, though at least I talked us into a cabin.
The Birdcage Library by Freya Berry is read by Samara McLaren and Lauren Allman and runs for 14 hours, 17 minutes.
And we'll have two more brand new books later in the show.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Daniel Tammet, acclaimed author and an autistic savant himself, reaches across the divides of age, gender, sexuality and nationality to draw out the inner worlds of his subjects. His book, Nine Minds, Inner Lives on the Spectrum, includes a chapter on Amanda, a blind autistic academic from Australia. The book is read by Jess Nestling and Mark Meadows.
This is a book about the neurodivergent present, its past and possible futures, as told through the true stories of nine contemporary men and women on the autism spectrum. They come from England, Wales and Ireland, Canada, Australia and the United States, from France, Nigeria and Japan. They are children of the 90s and the 80s, of the 70s, 60s, 50s, and 40s. They have found fame in Hollywood, confronted head-on the world's violence, earned a doctorate in psychology, entered national politics, solved a homicide case, performed orthopedic surgery, published a breakout novel, learned to see with the ears and to speak through a computer device. Together, they form a unique group portrait of neurodiversity.
My new book is called Nine Minds. It's the story of nine autistic men and women from around the world, telling how they see the world, how they live. Obviously, it's about their careers, it's about their personal lives, it's about what we can see from the outside, but more importantly, it's also from the inside. It's also about their inner lives, their dreams, their hopes, their fears, their ambitions, their passions, things that we haven't really seen so much of in literature until now. You know, for a long time, scientists wrongly assumed that people on the spectrum didn't have inner lives at all. And so that was something that, coming from my own perspective as an autistic man, I really felt it was important to get the balance right, you know, and actually show that, no, these stories exist and we need to tell them, you know, in the same way that we tell stories about women's lives or LGBT lives or Black and Asian lives, you know, that again were historically underrepresented or ignored even by large swathes of literature for a long time.
In collecting these stories, I have thought about the many years of medical progress and societal change that made this project possible. Increasingly, specialists understand autism less in terms of disorder, a problem to be solved, and more as a natural cognitive difference, infinitely variable, found in between 1-2% of the general population. It was not so long ago, however, that these lives were deemed unfit for literature. If they went into print at all, it was often only as a list of symptoms in some doctor's case study. A reader could be forgiven then for believing that they possessed no vivid hopes or fears, no dreams or sense of destiny, none of the depth and complexity on which a universal story depends. Of course, in this, they were not alone. LGBT and Black stories, for instance, were for a long time similarly erased or marginalised. If, today, these and other minorities and minoritised communities are finding their voice and rightful place on bookshelves, the significant gaps where neurodivergent stories should be, while narrowing, still remain. It is precisely in order to fill such a gap that this book exists.
You told your own story in Born in a Blue Day, so tell us about that.
So I was born and raised in East London, parents, working class, very simple, but very loving. They had great instincts and they entrusted me to those instincts as parents. I was a very shy kid, very awkward, didn't understand much about the world. It was very baffling to me, social contact, eye contact, body language, understanding jokes, understanding metaphor. It's something that came with time and practice, but it wasn't something that came intuitively to me. And for a long time, I didn't understand why I was so different. You know, growing up in the 1980s, it was a time when autism was very little understood, you know, other than the most extreme cases. It was not really diagnosed and studied or talked about. And then when I was about 10, there was Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman. That was something that helped to get people talking about what this could be like, you know. And but again, it was a very specific form of autism. It's something that stays with people. It's obviously a very powerful film, but it's not really necessarily true to a lot of people's lived experience of the condition. So in Born on a Blue Day, I was in my 20s when I wrote that book. I wasn't a writer yet at that time, but it was a book I had to write in a sense in order to become a writer. And it allowed me to find my vocation in writing and go on to write many other books.
Has the title anything to do with synesthesia?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Synesthesia, which is more common on the spectrum than in what we call a neurotypical population. It's a mixing of the senses. So it's when you have one perception overlaid by another perception. So when I see words like Wednesday, which is the day I was born on, hence the colour Born on a Blue Day, it's blue. The word itself, Wednesday, is blue. The letter W specifically is blue, and it gives the colour to the whole word. And so all words that begin with the letter W have that colour, in the same way that words that begin with A are red, words that begin with E are green. It's innate. It's something that exists not only on the spectrum. Maybe 4 or 5% of the population have this experience. It might also, it's not my experience, but sometimes people will experience music. It can be audible, it's auditory, so people can listen to music and experience textures or tastes or colours. It's quite varied, rather like the spectrum itself, the autistic spectrum itself.
Now, language seems to be your specialty. Did you learn Icelandic in a week?
Yeah. Yes, I growing up in England, my parents only spoke to me in English, but I never felt like it was my first language. It was always something I felt different in, like a foreigner. And so as soon as I began to have the opportunity to learn other languages at school, for example, French and German, and then read about other languages in books, Esperanto, for example, it's something that really I felt, oh, well, so maybe this explains why I feel so different. You know, maybe I was born in the wrong country, in the wrong language. I should try and learn other languages. And maybe I'll come across my real mother tongue in a way. Of course, I never did. And when I got into my 20s, there was a documentary, a TV documentary that was made about me. And the producers had this idea of taking me to another country and seeing how quickly I could learn the language. And they chose Iceland. We flew out there. I had a week. A wonderful teacher became a very good friend of mine afterwards. And what she found so fascinating about my approach to words and language is not just the memory side, remembering all of the vocabulary and so on. It was actually more about creativity, actually playing with words, you know, actually inventing new words in Icelandic. And she said that was something she hadn't seen in her other students. And was really interesting. And after the week spent in Iceland, I was put on TV and gave an interview as best I could in Icelandic. Of course, I don't speak fluently, completely fluently Icelandic, but it was enough to give good, you know, fluent, understandable answers. And the Icelanders kind of fell in love with me at this point. I became ever after the man who learned Icelandic in a week. And even all these years later, people said to me, oh, you're the guy who learned Icelandic in a week. And they're very proud, because they're very proud of their language as well.
Now, the reason we started talking is your new book features someone who is a Braille user. Tell us about them.
Yes. So this is Amanda. She's Australian. She is incredibly gifted. And this in spite of, or also because of, her impairment. She's on the autistic spectrum. And she was also born blind. And she learned Braille at a very early age and learned to use the Perkins machine, obviously, as well, to learn to write with Braille. And she went on many years later to earn a doctorate in studying the influence of impairment and disability on literary creation. And one of the people she studied was Les Murray, an important, very important poet of the 20th century who was a Nobel Prize contender. And he was also autistic, and it was something that critics struggled to understand, because at that time, and even to this day, people assume you can't be one and the other. You know, you have to be one or the other. You can't be both at the same time. And Murray was a wonderful influence on my own writing, of course, as an autistic man with this vocation to write. And Amanda reached out to me because she had written about Les in her thesis. She'd written about myself a little bit in the thesis as well. And when she told me about her story, I said, well, could you please, Amanda, come and be part of my book, because your mind is just incredible with this, all the insight she's able to bring to Les's poetry, using not only, of course, her feel, you know, her touch, sense of touch, but also her synesthesia, because she also experiences words with all kinds of different sensations. And this is obviously, or I imagine it's also the influence of her autism on her blindness. And her perceptions are so rich and so interesting. What she's able to draw out of Les Murray's poetry is so fine and unique and, you know, insightful, that it's incredibly impressive.
You've narrated a number of your own books. How was that process?
It's great. It's important to me to make my work as accessible as possible to readers everywhere who will come across my work in different formats, you know. And reading my books has been really interesting, because it's a whole when you write, it's so intuitive. You almost don't know what you're doing in a way. Up to a point, it's in you hope you get your, you know, you follow your instincts. You've got some idea where you're going, of course, but still, it's a work in progress until it's done. And then when you're reading it back, and reading it for an audience, you kind of rediscover what you're doing. You rediscover the work, and I'm a very visual person, so actually having that auditory approach, it gives a whole another side to what I'm doing, and I realize, okay, so it reassures me, because when I'm reading it, it's fluent. I'm saying, okay, this is good. You know, there's alliteration in there, an assonance. It's fluent. It reads well. So this is a good sign. With my most recent book, it was because it's the story of other people and men and women on the spectrum, and the publisher had the idea of bringing in voice actors, professional voice actors, which I thought was a really nice touch as well, because it means that they are able to use all of their amazing talents, you know, as actors, voice actors, to embody these very different, you know, lives, and with the accents as well, you know, bringing in all these different accents, which I couldn't do. So I hats off to them.
Do you think you'd be able to learn Braille?
That's a really good question. It's something that would be not easy, I reckon, because as an adult now in my 40s, I don't know how acute my sense of touch is compared to what it would have been like as a child growing up. I should probably try, you know, at some point, certainly learning about the experience of acquiring Braille from Amanda. Learning firsthand, you know, what it's like to use Braille on a day-to-day basis, it made me really think a lot about that experience and what it's like, and how rich and enriching it is. Obviously, it's an amazing invention, and it's what, 200 years?
200 years.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful invention, and it's great that it's still, obviously, it's still around all these years there, because it's so useful. It's so, it makes people's lives so much better, you know, gives them access to culture and the arts and the world, you know, more generally. So it's wonderful.
Over the past 20 years now, I have written the stories, beginning with my own, of those who perceive the world in radically different ways. In that time, my writing has evolved across genres: memoir, essay, fiction, poetry, literary reportage, the better to capture and illuminate for the general reader the many intricacies of the neurodiverse experience. I am ever grateful to all those who entrust their stories to me, who honor me with their faith that I will locate the form and the words that I hope can do them justice.
Nine Minds by Daniel Tammet is available in print, ebook, and in audio commercially. His book Born on a Blue Day is also available in audio and braille from RNIB Libraries.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And now on RNIB Connect Radio, let's take our second visit to the RNIB Library.
We have one for fans of gritty crime. True Detectives by Jonathan Kellerman was gifted to us by Headline.
Reed smoked his Parliament down to a shred, pinched it cold between his fingers, flicked the remnant out the window. He was a ruddy blonde fireplug, 5'9 on a good day, 200 muscled pounds, 30 but looking older, with skin leathered by the sun and a nose flattened by high school football. A hay-colored crew cut topped his bullet skull. A naturally grainy voice was coarsened further by 2 packs a day. 3 years out of the service, all his time spent running an armory in Germany. He said, "Tell you what alleged is, Darius. L.A. night's cooling off. Night like this might as well have stayed in Bull Shoals. And miss the opportunity to ride with me?" Reed grinned. Perish the thought.
True Detectives follows Mo Reed and Aaron Fox on the twisted trail of a missing girl, a dark, baffling whodunit that forces the brothers to put aside their mutual animus and to confront the unresolved family mystery that turned them into enemies. PIs can do things legally that cops can't, and cops have access to resources denied their private counterparts. Only by pooling their efforts and by consulting a man both brothers respect, psychologist Alex Delaware, do Fox and Reed stand a chance of peeling back the secrets in high places that explain the fate of an outwardly innocent young woman. And by doing so, the brothers learn much more about much more than murder.
"Damn heat," said Fox, dabbing sweat from his straight-edge mustache. He was a tall, rangy black man, 31 years old, a former Air Force mechanic who'd been told by many people that he was handsome enough to act. Jack Reed, a small-town Arkansas boy, was comfortable with black people in a way Northerners could never be. He found L.A. scary, everyone pretending to love everyone else, but the streets hummed with anger. Working with a black man, sitting side by side, eating, talking, trusting your life to a black man, was a whole different level of comfort for a transplanted Southerner, and he was surprised how fast he'd gotten used to riding with Darius. Knowing what Darius was thinking, without Darius having to put it into words. He could only imagine what his cousins would say if he bothered to talk to them anymore, which he didn't. All that ignorance and stupidity was history. He contemplated another cigarette as Darius exited the alley, drove a block, entered a neighboring back lane. More garbage and accordion-grated rear doors. Same old, same old. Both patrolmen were bored and crazy hot. Darius used his forearm to wipe sweat off his chin. Shiny nails flashed. Jack resisted the urge to kid his partner about the weekly manicures. Night like this, no sense being tiresome.
True Detectives by Jonathan Kellerman is read by Jeff Harding and runs for 11 hours, 4 minutes.
For those fascinated by true crime, Penguin Random House have donated The Real Happy Valley, True Stories of Crime and Heroism from Yorkshire's Frontline Policewomen by Alex Finton.
Nearly every police officer, by the time they reach the end of their career, will have talked at least one person out of suicide. Whilst the vast majority of the public would see this as saving a person's life, most officers would consider it just another part of the day job. Like me, many hardcore Happy Valley fans got sucked right in from episode one, where we see fictional Sergeant Catherine Carwood talking down a suicidal youth who has doused himself in petrol. In her usual, upfront, no-nonsense style, Catherine manages to break down the barrier of her uniform by personalizing herself in just 3 brilliant sentences in which she explains her personal situation. Divorced, middle-aged, living with her recovering drug addict sister, having 2 adult children, although one is dead, the other estranged, by way of showing the boy that things aren't so rosy in her life either, and engaging him in conversation to stop his suicide attempt.
A collection of real-life cases showing the bravery of female police officers. Former police constable Alice Finton shares the stories of brave policewomen who spent their entire careers at the sharp end of crime fighting. The Real Happy Valley reveals what life in the beat is really like, from dealing with domestic abuse cases to facing personal assaults, gang crime, and murder, these courageous women stop at nothing to bring criminals to justice, never failing to put others' safety before their own. Gripping and inspiring, The Real Happy Valley is a celebration of our finest policewomen's extraordinary courage and their peerless commitment to protect and serve.
Police Sergeant Kate Dungay pushes wearily into the exit door, using the weight of her tired body to swing it outwards, a blast of cold air making her shiver as she steps from the police station into the yard. She's just finished a 10-hour night shift and can't wait to get home to her bed. The fresh October morning air does nothing to stave off her aching exhaustion. Yawning, she rummages in her trouser pocket for her car keys, ambling towards where she thinks she's parked. She can hear some kind of commotion coming from the back of the car park, but her ears are closed to it. Let someone else sort that out, she thinks. I've dealt with enough for one shift. Being the duty sergeant, she'd been responsible for her team for the Friday night shift. It had started with pub fights, where no one wanted to press charges. Her team, holding head wounds together and shoving non-cooperative people into ambulances. Then came the domestics, seven across their patch, just as the pubs began to empty out and drunk husbands came home to their wives. Two men, arrested for assault. One female for drink driving. That carried them through to the early morning, when anyone not already tucked away with a prisoner was out cruising the streets, putting their hands in pockets. She'd had a lot of paperwork to complete and supervise by the end of the shift, and she rubs her eyes as she makes it to her car. Plugging the key into the driver's door, her shoulders hunch as she hears footsteps quickly approach her from behind.
The Real Happy Valley. True Stories of Crime and Heroism from Yorkshire's Frontline Policewoman by Alice Vinton is read by Sarah Poyser and lasts for 7 hours 47 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's Read On, a return to Becky C. Brenhoff for the books of her life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, yeah. A Little Princess by Frances Hodgson Burnett. When I was little, my grandparents, they got me a collection of 20 classic children's books. And I think I just devoured them all over the Christmas holiday. But that one, that was one I kept coming back to. And I think of all of those books in that collection, I've still got it upstairs somewhere. And I just loved it. I think it might have been my gateway into feminism, weirdly enough. But yeah, it's just a wonderful story. And I really love Sarah Crewe as a character. Just, yeah, it gives me very warm, fuzzy feelings.
Once, on a dark winter's day, when the yellow fog hung so thick and heavy in the streets of London that the lamps were lighted and the shop windows blazed with gas as they do at night, an odd-looking little girl sat in a cab with her father and was driven rather slowly through the big thoroughfares. She sat with her feet tucked under her and leaned against her father, who held her in his arm, as she stared out of the window at the passing people with a queer, old-fashioned thoughtfulness in her big eyes. She was such a little girl that one did not expect to see such a look on her small face. It would have been an old look for a child of 12, and Sarah Crewe was only 7.
That's Elizabeth Proud reading from A Little Princess by Frances Hodgson Burnett, available in RNIB Library. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
So I don't really reread books, but I was thinking about this question and I realised at the moment, because of my baby, I am rereading a lot of children's books. So for any parents out there, I can highly recommend, because it was a huge hit in this house, a book by Emma Perry, and it's illustrated by Claire Alexander, and it's called Puddling, and it's all about three children who go out on a rainy day and play about in the puddles before, no spoilers, but before they come home and get a big snuggle. I don't know why, my son loves it. He goes nuts for this book, and it's just gorgeous and lovely.
Unfortunately, Puddling by Emma Perry isn't available in audio, although you will find some read-along videos on YouTube. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Oh, yeah, definitely. A book called So Thrilled For You by Holly Bourne. It's a really great whodunit, all about basically who set off this wildfire on the hottest day of the year that was started at a gender reveal party gone very, very wrong. That's the arc. But what it does is it's a real, quite frank and naked look at motherhood in lots of different forms. as someone who has sort of just come out of the newborn trenches and is now kind of getting into the rhythm of things, I felt very seen. I felt very validated. And it's about four friends who are at different stages. So there's one woman who has decided she would rather not have children, and it really looks at her point of view. There's another, a woman who is trying really hard to have kids and can't. There's one who's just about to have a baby. And there's one who's like really in the throes of it with an 18-month-old and is trying very hard to pretend that it's brilliant and she's not having that great a time. And it's just excellent.
The flames take the vulva pinata immediately. The crepe paper ripples in the magenta smoke, the sweets inside popping like corn kernels as they explode inside their wiry cage. The pinata falls onto the decking, and there's a moment of stillness in me. The first time I've felt calm in so long. As I take in the view, thinking, wow, I've never seen pink smoke before. Soon the flames will claim the pile of duck-patterned wrapping paper, gorge on the coarse wool of the hand-knitted blankets, and turn the fallen wall of peonies into a sweet, toxic perfume. I can tell already that everything is lost. My life has already burned down metaphorically, so it makes sense that I've now burned it down literally too. All I wanted to do was torch it all until there was nothing left but sooty soil, rich with nutrients to grow something new. But I never thought I'd actually do it. I watch the smoke plume out of the cannon, dancing as it eclipses the vista and spirals around in the heat, juxtaposed against the bluest sky. The fire around it ignites instantly, the smoke doubling, trebling, as flames catch and dance in the kindling. The heat slaps my face and wakes me up. I hear myself screaming at what I've done, and I run towards the heat.
So Thrilled For You by Holly Bourne is read by Emily Swage, Evie Ward-Drummond, Kelly Houghton, Paul Hertzberg and Rosalind Laney, and is available commercially. And once again, Becky, thanks so much.
Nah, thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.